and welcome to the final episode of this four-part series on moisture-associated skin damage. This podcast is brought to you by Wincare People in partnership with Medicare Plus International. This episode will discuss the evolution of MASD clinical practice now and into the future. This podcast is brought to you by Wincare People in partnership with Medicare Plus International. Let's start by discussing what classification and risk assessment tools are available to assist clinicians and carers.
Good question, Nicola. I think there are certainly a number of assessment tools available, and Tom DeFlore, this was in around 2005, his earlier work certainly highlighted the differences between incontinence-associated dermatitis and pressure ulcers. And this really reduced some of that confusion amongst clinicians, particularly between IAD and category 2 pressure ulceration. So this renowned publication certainly raised awareness, but I believe it also influenced innovation, really leading the way for the subsequent evolution of the validated Globiad classification tool. So both are really valuable tools, but unfortunately limited to IAD only. So therefore, that gives us less focus on the other types of MASD that we talked about. And as we know, this could then result in misdiagnosis or mismanagement. Also, the Globiad classification tool uses numbers to classify severity, but the similarity this has to the UPRAT pressure ulcer classification of category 1 and 2 could lead to confusion amongst clinicians. So interestingly, since the publication of those tools, further developments have been made to address some of those limitations.
So what are these developments?
Well, if I may answer, a more recent MASD assessment tool that's been developed, which I think is gathering quite a lot of momentum at the moment, it's been widely adopted, is the SMART resource. We discussed this in episodes 2 and 3. The tool is clear, it's concise, and it's easily understood by any level of user, and it allows the healthcare practitioner to effectively categorise the extent of skin damage and give the patient the most appropriate treatment at the right time.
And can I just add to that, Dale? This is some really good examples of those assessment tools and management tools. But I want to emphasise that really this should be used in conjunction, I feel, with and I think we all agree with this, a patient risk assessment. You know, that risk assessment, you know, is in identifying and establishing those patients at risk, and also for prevention of that MASD, as opposed to managing the MASD when it occurs.
So what do you feel is missing at the moment?
As I've mentioned, what really would be useful is a valid and reliable MASD risk assessment tool. It can predict the patient's level of risk. It can categorise them accordingly. You know, for example, no risk, at risk, high or very high risk. It can be based on specific extrinsic and intrinsic factors, and we can then predict the likelihood of MASD occurring. It would massively help staff identifying an individual's level of risk, you know, for example, admission on to hospital on the first community visit or admission to a care setting, and of course minimize that further risk by identifying the priorities of care, which is important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite hard to believe almost that we don't have a risk assessment tool for moisture-associated skin damage. But certainly in my experience, I think that what healthcare practitioners often fail to recognise is that there is a clear difference between a classification tool and a risk assessment tool. So a classification tool is used to determine the extent of damage after it has occurred, which is certainly required. But whereas a risk assessment tool aims to identify patients at risk of additional harm, and that can then enable appropriate preventative interventions or indeed identify those who are not at risk. So as Joy said, that's really what's missing at the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, thinking about sort of MASD and sort of pressure also risk assessment tools, let's use the Purpose T as an example, because this tool not only acknowledges the risk of moisture on the skin due to urine and feces, like, you know, most of the other pressure ulcer risk assessments commonly used do, but it also recognises risk associated with excessive perspiration and wound exudate, which we know or the other causes of MASD. So these tools are extremely useful, but they only identify excessive moisture as a risk factor for pressure ulceration. And we need to recognise that they do not predict the potential risk of MASD developing or occurring, which we know is a common precursor to pressure ulcers in the first place. So in order for timely interventions, the healthcare practitioner needs to be made more aware that skin moisture as a specific risk factor may require additional support in conjunction with any strategy that's implemented to prevent or manage pressure ulceration.
Do you think there's a likelihood that we will see a specific risk assessment tool being developed for MASD in the future?
Yes, Nicola, definitely. What I can say is that this is something that Alison Dale and myself are currently working on. We've been looking at the evidence around, of course, MASD, but specifically risk assessment, and we noted that there was a gap in practice. So we are now developing a MASD risk assessment tool, and we'll hopefully share that with you later on in the year.
So now that we've discussed assessment and classification, can we talk about the management tools that are available to help clinicians and carers?
Well, I mean, there are plenty of sort of simple clinical pathways that are being developed on a local level to assist the clinician with the management of MASD. There's also generic templates that have been produced by many of the companies that manufacture or distribute skin barrier products. And these templates can be tailored and aligned to local skin and wound care formularies. So that, you know, all of these are designed to simplify that decision-making process and to ensure that the products are used appropriately. And without sounding like a stuck record, I'm going to refer back to the NICE endorsed smart resource. Again, this offers some really clear but generic guidance on how to manage various extents of MASD.
Yes, I agree, Dale. And in addition to advocating the smart resource, certainly in Nottingham where I work, we've also developed a pre-formatted moisture-associated skin damage care plan for System One, which is the electronic system we use. And that includes a number of instructions pivotal to MASD management. So it offers generic instruction initially, and it's then based on the SMART guidance for the management of the severity of damage in relation to mild, moderate, and severe. So I think it's a valuable starting point. I think it needs to evolve, which hopefully it will over time, but it is being used currently in clinical practice.
I think that, you know, Alison, is just a really good example. Well, we've had some good examples of the resources. You know, we've talked about the SMART and the other resources, but certainly these pre-formatting care plans, you know, particularly around a confusion around MASD, can really be beneficial. I mean, just most recently, you know, I've visited lots of different care settings. I went into a nursing home and saw a patient with IAD, and they had a care plan implemented, a management plan implemented. And then I went to a patient in his own home, and he had IAD, but a different management plan was implemented. And then onto the acute ward, and again, a different management plan for that patient. So you can understand how there's a lot of confusion, not just amongst clinicians and carers, but the patients themselves, you know, when we're educating about the management of their MASD. And if they're transferred into different care settings, it does cause confusion. So to me, those pre-formatting care plans for specific types of MASD can really help, I think, reduce those variations in treatment and promote continuity of care.
So you've just spoken about pre-formatted treatment plans. Do you think there should be a different management plan for each type of MASD?
Absolutely, Nicola. You know, firstly, yes, we need to establish the diagnosis of that MASD. What type of MASD? Because if we don't know what has caused the MASD, what extrinsic and intrinsic factors have led to it, how can we effectively manage it? And each type of MASD, which we have mentioned in the previous podcast, will require slightly different management plans. You know, so we can't address the management plans under one big umbrella. They need their individual specific management plan for each type of MASD. So, yes.
Yeah, absolutely, Joy. I agree. And I think that's where certainly the plan that I've devised can be developed further. But I also think that care plans can be viewed as just another paper exercise. And so, you know, we really need to be mindful of not overloading healthcare practitioners with additional documentation, even more so in the current pandemic. But I also believe, as you say, that a simple to use pre-formatted treatment plan for MASD can save time in addition to capturing the essence of that care delivery.
So yeah, I think so too, Alison. You know, definitely, I do think in certain situations there's a need to be more prescriptive with patient care. You know, healthcare services rely heavily at the moment on agency staff who are often unfamiliar with the area in which they're working in. So these sort of pre-formatted treatment plans could facilitate a more consistent approach to the provision of care and reduce, as Joy said, the confusion, particularly with temporary and agency staff. Absolutely.
So how can current ways of working evolve to improve practice?
That's a really good question there, Nicola. I think, you know, we need stronger emphasis locally, nationally and internationally to continue to raise awareness. I think, you know, going back slightly, I think Stop the Pressure Day had a huge impact on practice improvement and highlighted what needed to change and to what extent. So it was put in place to try and solve this often preventable problem. You know, this is an annual event held on every third Thursday in November. It brings together industry, healthcare professionals and the media from across the world, and they all come together in a bid to increase public knowledge and awareness of a problem that's affecting so many people each year.
Yeah, and I think it's a fantastic campaign, Dale. I totally agree. And as we're aware, we talked a lot about the national and international pressure officer campaign, and on the back of all of the good work, you know, we saw NHS England in 2015 introduce the React to Red campaign. And that again raised awareness of pressure ulcer prevention. And we know pressure ulcer prevention is one of the biggest challenges that care organisations face, you know, and cost a terrific amount of money to manage, you know, overall 6.5 million per year in the UK. And I mean, it's a massive campaign. What I liked about the campaign as well is it's evolved as new evidence is been introduced and new ideas, you know. So we had the ESKIM framework and now that's evolved into the ASKING framework. And as we know, it's an acronym, but a really good acronym to guide staff in that assessment. So it represents assessing the risk, the skin assessment and care, looking at the support service, keep moving and mobility, incontinence and increased moisture, which again is so important when we're talking about MASD, nutrition, hydration, and the G I absolutely love, giving information. So that's to carers and to patients. So this is around the pressure ulcer campaign, but it's something that we can certainly learn from when we're talking about MASD and prevention.
Yeah, absolutely, Joy. And through the success of that campaign, which really has become embedded into clinical practice, it also became evident that a resource focusing on moisture damage was also required. And this led to the React to Moisture campaign. This was developed following funding from the East Midlands Academic Health Science Network. And it was written by Nottinghamshire Healthcare Tissue Viability Team and also reviewed by the Specialist Continence Team. It's a really valuable educational resource, well worth a watch, very easy to watch. It was initially targeted at care homes, but actually can be opened up for everybody as a really valuable resource. It has a training video, patient information leaflet, and it also has a competency assessment document, which I think is crucial to clinical practice.
Yeah, I've used this, Alison, and I'm well done to Nottingham because it is a fantastic resource. I was also looked and implemented a similar initiative that was developed in Liverpool around about 2019, and that used the acronym MINIMISE. And that again was an education and awareness campaign which focused on actions to reduce the local incidence of MASD, particularly IAD. And that too included a protocol to guide healthcare practitioners on what products to use, and it did, you know, prove to be extremely effective. So again, another good example of a local initiative.
Yep, so it's good to acknowledge these local, national and international campaigns, but we mustn't forget there's a vast amount of published evidence available. And last year, we had two really useful international consensus documents produced. We had the International Skin Tear Advisory Panel Maintaining Skin Integrity document, which again refers to MASD. But we also had the International Consensus Document Prevention and Management of Moisture-Associated Skin Damage. Both of these documents allude to the key points that we've collectively discussed in the series of podcasts that we've recorded. So fantastic resources.
Thanks very much. We're now going to hear a short message from our sponsors.
This podcast is brought to you by Medicare Plus International, leading the way in skin and wound care. To find out more about the products and resources mentioned on this podcast, please visit www.medicareplus.co.uk.
How can healthcare providers and organisations determine that the initiatives that they adopt are effective?
Gosh, it's a great question, Nicola, and certainly one that commissioners often want answers to. And I think to gain insight into the effectiveness at national level, of course, this really needs to be achieved through mandated and standardised reporting processes through DATIX, which we have all become familiar with through the reporting of pressure ulcers. But interestingly, currently, DATIX incident reporting is inconsistent across organisations for MASD, so it only focuses on IAD. So I really think that in order to move this forward, there needs to be consistency in not only reporting all types of MASD, but also in monitoring the severity of damage in relation to mild, moderate and severe. So it's twofold really in improving that consistency.
I totally agree with that. You know, that we've talked at length, haven't we, Alison, about that reporting process, and I totally agree with what you've said. You know, I feel as well that all organisations, we should be recording patient-reported outcome measures, and I know some organisations do and some don't. You know, what that will aim to do is it will address of what is the input of my care or the care I've implemented. You know, so what's the outcome of the assessment and management plan I've implemented for that patient with MASD? So it's a really excellent way of addressing, well, this is working really well, but actually this needs improving. And so, you know, your own local area can look at that and implement different changes. What it also does, I find, is it offers reassurance to the healthcare commissioners and the providers and to us as clinicians ourselves that we are, you know, implementing that evidence-based assessment and care. I even think a national sequencing framework around MASD would be beneficial as well in the future. Again, encouraging that consistent recording and reporting of MASD prevalence, but also recording the management, as you've just mentioned, you know, the effective management against evidence. So, you know, again, looking at areas that may require changes in practice and those areas that actually show, you know, effective good practice that we can learn from.
In terms of care delivery, what should we expect in the future as we progress and hopefully overcome the impact of COVID-19?
If only I had a crystal ball. This is it's a very interesting question and one that's raised a lot of discussion recently. Healthcare services have been up against unprecedented challenges during the coronavirus pandemic, which has affected many general and specialist care services. You know, tissue viability services included have had to drastically reduce their provision, and specialist nurses that were redeployed to help out in other areas. So during the first wave of the pandemic back in sort of March last year, we saw preventative work being put on hold. Person-to-person services and clinics were suspended, and some areas even had difficulties providing basic skin and wound care advice and support due to limited resources and lack of staff.
Oh, absolutely, Dale. That, you know, this pandemic's forced us all to adapt to a new normal and certainly rethink about care delivery strategies. And because of it, you know, we've seen a huge increase in the use of technology to enable us to make contact and monitor our patients. And of course, as well as communicating with our colleagues. It's something I feel really passionate about. Telemedicine and video consultations, we know, have become a vital part of this new way of working and have, you know, as I've said, proven to be extremely beneficial in certain situations, both for the clinician and the patient. You know, for example, it cuts down on travel time to and from the hospital or the clinic appointments or home visits. And that can mean that more patients can be seen by the healthcare practitioner and much sooner. I think it's a new way of working.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we also need to acknowledge that some patients, and again, we've certainly seen this in clinical practice, some patients who are concerned about COVID-19 or are shielding, they would prefer clinicians not to visit them in their homes. And that brings different problems in itself. But this is where telemedicine, video consultation can offer great benefits to support both patients and families in their home.
100% agree, Alison. You know, going back a few years in the past, the notion of using telemedicine in tissue viability was considered a taboo subject. You know, many specialist practitioners were rejecting this concept because it just wouldn't work. Okay, but now, with the advancement of technology, we can speak to another person on the other side of the world in real time through our mobile devices. And the pandemic has certainly proved otherwise. You know, it does work. And in some situations, it can certainly increase clinical efficiency and productivity.
Yeah, and I've had exact, you know, I've worked in an area where they've used a lot of telemedicine, and you're right, Dale, it certainly has done that. I think what we can also expect to see, though, I think, is much more of an emphasis on supported or shared care where that may be appropriate, you know, appropriate for the patient. Supported and shared care can empower our patients and carers to be more involved with their own care delivery. And of course, at the same time, reassuring them, and what we must emphasise is they won't be left abandoned, you know, that we are still there to offer support, advice, etc. It can be done by, you know, ensuring that we've got simple patient care information, guidance, and also signpost the patients and the carers to additional information such as who to contact, how to contact, when to contact them if there's a problem. So, you know, I think that is another emphasis that we're seeing as well in practice.
Yeah, I totally agree, Joy. And I think we will also see a major shift with how clinicians access training. You know, it's essential that skills are not lost and that the care is not compromised through lack of access to education. You know, we can't do, and we haven't been able to for several months, for over a year, face-to-face training. So we still need to ensure education is available for all those healthcare practitioners. And since the beginning of the pandemic, we've seen this delivered, a wealth of training delivered very effectively online. It's a new way of working.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the increase in remote working, we've got less face-to-face peer support, will mean that these online platforms will definitely have to be utilised more frequently. And you know, we urge healthcare practitioners, where possible, to revisit relevant websites and podcasts. They're really useful resources.
Yeah, and there's some really good e-learning opportunities also available online. You know, I frequently revisit them as well, because sometimes I think you can visit them once and then, you know, obviously time moves on and we're busy, and I often revisit those e-learning websites as well. You know, examples of the e-learning for healthcare are those produced by our industry partners as well. There's some really good social and media forums, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And again, that's where we can not just get additional guidance, but also offer us all support, you know, offer support to each other as well, which I think is important.
Final question to each of you. If you could change one thing tomorrow in relation to MASD, what would it be? Dale, do you want to go first?
Well, the answer is quite simple for me. And we've alluded to this throughout the episodes of these podcasts. And what I would say is we need a specific MASD patient risk assessment tool. This is simple.
Yeah, for me, in addition to that, Dale, I'd like to see a standardised reporting process across all organisations, you know, not just incidence or prevalence, but going further than that with patient-reported outcome measures in place. And who knows, maybe a national sequin.
Yep, I agree. And for me, I think we need a clear strategy for the prevention and management of MASD. We have some great resources, as we've said, to support healthcare practitioners. And if a risk assessment tool is developed, and that then leads us to the implementation of a pre-formatted preventative plan of care, which we don't currently have in clinical practice in the way that we do have with pressure ulcers. And then in addition to this, a pre-formatted treatment plan could then be more specifically aligned to the SMART resource tool. So I know that's more than one change, Nicola, sorry. But for MASD, I really believe it's the synergy of risk assessments, prevention planning, and treatment strategies that will result in embedding that proactive approach to MASD into clinical practice.
Thanks, Alison, Joy, and Dale for another thought-provoking discussion. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this series on MASD, and if so, please keep an eye out for our future podcast series. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Medicare Plus International, leading the way in skin and wound care. To find out more about the products and resources mentioned on this podcast, please visit medicareplus.co.uk.